Hey, welcome to Your Turn, Mike Causey. Glad to have you with us in this really chilly day here. And we got we know we have a good show because we've been getting telephone calls and emails by the boatload here, and won't waste any time. My guest is Tammy Flanagan. She is Senior Benefits Director at the National Institutes of Transition Planning, NITP, has been for a long time, and has a background in HR work in the federal government. Tammy, real quickly, you were at the FBI at one point, right?
That's right. Many, many years ago in the 1980s, that's where I started my government career, and that's where I really learned a lot about retirement planning because I worked as a retirement counselor there.
Well, they had a superb program. I remember going to it. In fact, I maybe met you at some of those, but they really took care of their own people.
Yeah, those were the days when they used to do the regional retirement training. I think they lasted about a week, but unfortunately, those days are over.
Yeah, I met some really wonderful people, not only employees, but people in the benefits world that were so good that they went there. But anyhow, delighted to have you with us now, and we're going to go right to the phones and the emails here, and we got a call from Sue in D.C. She's looking to retire May 31st, and when can I expect my first annuity check, and is it better to retire at the end of the month or June 1st?
Well, okay, so a couple of things. She's asking about the best date to retire because it looks like she's ready to go at the end of May. And I brought my calendar with me, so I'm looking at the calendar for May 31st, which happens to be a Saturday, and it's also the end of leave period 10 this year for most employees. So I can't think of a better date if that's about the time of the year that she wants to go. If she's CSRS, she could retire June 1st, 2nd, or 3rd and still get a retirement check for the month of June, but she's not going to gain too much other than 3 additional days of service and 1 day of salary.
Yeah.
So unless, you know, sometimes when somebody retires, especially when we add on the sick leave, you'll say, oh, okay, I've got 35 years, 9 months, and 28 days of service. And your retirement's computed on just the years and months, so those 28 days would be lost. So the only advice I'd give her is if she gets that final retirement calculation and finds that she's in that close to another month category, that if she's CSRS, she could retire up to June 3rd and still be okay. But other than that, I'd say May 31st is the date.
And when she's going to get her first full, I assume she means her first full annuity check.
Well, okay, that's crystal ball projection. But right now, the last month, and of course January's results aren't out yet, those will be interesting, but the last month, the end of December, OPM's backlog was down to about 12,000 cases. And it sounds like a lot of work for OPM to do. That means 12,000 people's retirement applications are sitting there waiting to be processed. But in a good month, when OPM works overtime, they can knock out 15,000 cases. So that means their backlog, other than what came in January, at the end of December, January, and even early February, that's going to go back up again because this is a very popular time to retire, on top of the fact that FERS employees finally got their 100% sick leave. So I imagine a lot of them waited until January to retire. So if that backlog stays low, hopefully within 3 months of her retirement, if she doesn't have any complications in her case, she can probably get her full retirement check. I think they're really getting close to that three-month turnaround.
And I think a lot of people aren't aware of the fact that when you retire, you don't get your check immediately. You get an estimated check based on what they think you're going to get, and it typically runs about 80% of what they think you're entitled to, but we've heard it as low as 40 also.
Well, yeah, can I do a little bit of a rundown on that? So when somebody's like this woman here is saying, okay, I want to retire May 31st. So the first thing is when should you turn in your application? So I would say, depending on the size of her agency and how busy they are in retirement applications, minimum 30 days, but I would say more than likely 60 to 90 days, which means you back that up May, April, March, you know, I'd say around March is when I'd be turning in that application to make sure that my agency has time to do what they need to do to process the application because they've got to put together the package. And I do mean package of papers because it's going to be all the information from your official personnel folder, like your SF-50s, your personnel action statements, your health insurance, your life insurance documents. And all of that gets printed on paper because OPM still processes these retirement claims on a paper-based, you know, just manual labor basis. So you got to leave time for that. Also leave time that if they find a discrepancy in your records or there's some missing service records or there's not documentation that you have 5 years of federal health insurance, you want to leave time to find that before you actually walk out the door. So assuming that you have that clean case, then it goes to OPM after you retire. You know, payroll's got to pay out your last paycheck. They have to pay for your annual leave lump sum. So if you retire May 31st, everything's not going to end up at OPM until the end of June. Yeah. Some of it will go sooner, some will go later.
Got a related question here from Teresa. She says, what paperwork is necessary to hand to my manager? Do I have to give my retirement papers to my manager, or can I just send them or take them somewhere and not even tell anyone in the office until after I retire? Got a couple more years to go before retirement, but I have questions about it. And a lot of people don't want to become lame ducks.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true. I used to feel like we were, you know, like a doctor's office in the retirement office because people didn't want no one to know their business.
Yeah.
And I can understand that because people get worried that someone's waiting for them to leave to take their desk. So you don't necessarily have to tell your manager 3 months ahead of time that you're leaving. You can turn your application in, generally to HR. Now, once you turn that in, that does start the ball rolling in many agencies where they may notify your time and attendance people and so forth. So you might want to have a talk with your retirement specialist to make sure that this doesn't go any further if you are going to start exploring that or turning the application in early. So check with your own individual agency. But I know that you can turn the application in without going through your manager.
Surprise the boss, I know someone who did that. They did not want to be a lame duck, but they had a planned retirement date. And in the meantime, they got a promotion. So that she decided to stay on. And she always felt that if she hadn't kept it secret, she would have retired. Or if she'd announced she was going to retire, she wouldn't have gotten the offer.
She probably wouldn't have.
From Wendy on Los Angeles here, she wants to know, will we archive this show? Yes, we will. We finish up here at 11 a.m., and the show should be archived by noon.
So people
can listen to that. Here's one from Yvonne. The IRS. I understand you're taking questions of the show today. I am so confused about the government pension offset. I've talked to retirement specialists and Social Security. No one can give me an answer about its impact on retirement. And I am so glad you are here because I used to know a lot about GPO, but I've mercifully forgotten it all.
Yeah, I remember you've coined that the evil twins because there's the windfall provision and there's the government pension offset.
Yeah, one of them's going to get you,
Yeah, you'll be hit by both in some cases. So the government pension offset is only going to affect you if you receive a pension that you've earned from work where you didn't pay into Social Security. So that means if you're under FERS, don't worry about it. You're not going to have to worry about the government pension offset. But if you're under CSRS when you retire, that is a pension from work where you didn't pay into Social Security. So what this means is that when you get a civil service retirement, you're not considered a dependent spouse like someone who didn't work outside the home for the last 30 years. You have this retirement based on the work that you did. So apparently Congress didn't feel like you should get the same spousal benefits that someone would have received had they been financially dependent on their spouse. And by the way, up until the mid-70s, we called this a dependent wife's benefit because it was only payable to women. And that's still today who really gets mostly impacted by this provision. So what happens is when you retire and you get, let's say, $3,000 a month, which is a pretty moderate civil service retirement. There's many that are much higher than that. But let's say it's $3,000 a month, and then you go to claim Social Security on your spouse. Let's say it's your husband, and maybe his benefit's $1,800 a month. So you're thinking, I'll get half of his while he's living, and if he dies first, I get all of it. Don't get your hopes up, because they're going to take Social Security will offset that $1,800 or that $900 by two-thirds of your government pension. So if your government pension's only $3,000 a month, two-thirds of that's still $2,000, which is more than even the $1,800 widow's benefit. You won't get any of it. So in many cases, you should still apply. You know, never not apply. If it's a double negative, but don't, you know, always apply for the Social Security, but don't be surprised that that offset wipes it out completely.
Yeah, bad, always bad news with a windfall elimination and offset. And Lauren Larson is giving us the evil eye here. Got to take a short break. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com. Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with Tammy Flanagan. She is benefits director at for the National Institutes of Transition Planning. A lot of emails and calls stacking up here, so I'm going to go right to it. Here's one from Julia, actually two. First one, Julia, we can't handle because it's about a Roth IRA, and Tammy's boss, Bob Lyons, should be in on that. But he has a good point here. She says, I want to go out quietly. Personnel tells me they're required to contact my front office as soon as I submit my retirement application. Then how come people in the past have been able to walk out and not tell anybody? Is that an individual agency preference?
That's what I said before. I said, you know, contact HR and let them know what you want to do and find out if that's their procedure, is to contact your front office. Because sometimes it is and sometimes they can put it off. Because I've been in agencies where they do it both ways. If you really are concerned about that, which I don't advise this, but you could wake up Monday morning and say Friday was my last day.
Yeah.
And not give any notice. I certainly don't recommend that for you or your agency's sake.
But
that would be the way to make sure that that happened.
More people have. Here's one. Maxine, she's a special agent in Buffalo, New York, wants to know if we have transcripts or these shows are archived. We do not have transcripts, unfortunately, but they are archived. This show should be up and running about noon. So if any of your friends miss it or if you want to hear it again, just go to our homepage and there it is. Here's one from Betsy, and she says, how do withholdings differ if I take a lump sum versus terminal leave at the end of my service? Mm-hmm. I'm CSRS offset. Does Social Security treat the two situations differently? CSRS. I'm lost.
Yeah, what she's wanting to know is, she says, you know, she's got some leave. Let's say she has 200 hours of leave. So she's thinking, maybe I should just go on annual leave, tell my boss I'm going to be on vacation, and then retire when the vacation's over. And during that time, I'll accumulate additional service. I'll still be able to contribute to the thrift. I'll still, you know, be accumulating Social Security benefits. So why not do that? Couple of reasons. Number one, your boss could say no, because there was a ruling made years ago by the Comptroller General that said that federal employees are not to take terminal leave, because that means while you're on leave, we can't replace you and you're going to be leaving anyway, so would rather just pay you for your leave. So you probably shouldn't do it by that standard. If in the event that your boss says, well, we'll let you do it anyway, I still don't think you should do it, especially if you're under CSRS, because during the time you're using that leave, you're giving up your lump sum payment and you're giving up a couple of retirement checks you could have received. So you're really only working for the difference between the value of the leave and the value of your retirement and your full salary, which for a lot of CSRS employees is only a 20% difference. So, you know, absolutely under CSRS, don't do it. Take the lump sum. Under FERS, I could kind of see the point, especially for someone who doesn't have a lot of service, who wants to, you know, get their full salary for a few more months and their retirement's only going to be, you know, a couple thousand a month anyway. So I could see a FERS employee wanting to do that and probably benefiting from doing that more than a CSRS employee.
Okay, good advice. Mm-hmm. Here's one from Brian in Bethesda, Maryland. My wife's 55, but only started working for the feds at age 52. Her goal is to work until age 62. Her health is not the greatest, but we're hoping she can hang in for 10 years as a fed. Can someone realistically retire under the FERS system at age 62? And he said, I will have 30 years as a fed when I reach 56.
Okay. Yeah, well, a couple of things. Yes, someone can retire from FERS at age 62, and in her case, she'll have 10 years of service, and she'll be eligible for a basic retirement benefit based on those 10 years. And roughly, it's 10% or 10 times 1% of her high three salary. So, yeah, she'll get something to show for it. The other thing he mentioned was she's not in the best of health. And under FERS, with only 18 months of service, you're eligible to apply for disability retirement. So if her health makes it so that she can't continue working until age 62, I would encourage her to look at the possibility of applying for disability retirement under FERS, which would also require a Social Security disability application. She may get one and not the other, but it's still worth a shot if that's why she can't work till 62.
Okay. Here's one from Josephine in Atlanta, and she said, after following Tammy's advice for several years, my magic date is Friday.
This
good for her. Okay. While in the middle of the pay period as a FERS employee, is it to my advantage to go on the last day of the month and earn another week's pay rather than wait for an additional 8 hours of leave?
Oh, okay. I think she's saying, should I retire January 31st or wait till the end of the pay period, which would be the following week, February 7th. No, don't wait till February 7th, because here's the basic rule that I think everybody needs to know when they're picking a retirement date. Under FERS, no matter what day of the month you retire, your retirement doesn't start till the next month. So in other words, if she chose to retire February 7th, which, yes, she'll accumulate another accrual of leave, she'll get another week of salary, but her salary will stop February 7th, and she won't get a retirement check till April 1st for the month of March. So the rest of February is not compensated. She won't get salary. She won't get a partial retirement check.
So the 31st is her date.
Good. Yeah. So you want to.
She also adds, this was written this morning, she said, today in Atlanta, major highways are closed because of the roads. We're still filled with drivers stuck on the road since early yesterday afternoon. How about that? I mean,
yeah, the South
things
isn't
are bad
prepared for that bad weather. It's awful.
Yeah, terrible. Okay.
Not that we are, right?
Yeah. Look who's talking.
Yeah.
Okay, here's one from Dave in Fedland. Okay, and he says, as the Thrift Savings Plan has done well for me, I'm considering retiring at the end of the year, despite FERS pension penalty for being 56. The Department of Commerce currently generously compensates me as a GS 14 Step 10, and I max out paying my Social Security payments around the end of October when we're not furloughed or shut down anyway, as I will have 408 hours of leave by October 31st and about 440 hours by December 31st. Does it make sense to take the retirement at the end of October and skip the Social Security payments for lump sum leave payment?
Okay. This is the question you sent me ahead of time, so I had a little bit of time to work on it, because it is a kind of an interesting question, and it's going to really be relevant mostly to the higher salaried folks. So this is for people who earn enough money so that they don't have to pay the Social Security tax at the end of the year, because every year there's this maximum taxable wage amount. So for this year, it's $117,000. So he's saying he's going to max out at $117,000. Sounds like around the end of October. And if you're even at the highest salary at $155,000, you'd max out at the end of September.
Yeah.
So somewhere, you know, September, October, he's thinking he's going to retire. So if he did that and he retired at that point and then cashed out that annual leave, which could be a lump sum payment of $20,000-$30,000, he's saying, well, that's great. I don't have to pay the 6.2% on that. True. However, if he kept working until the end of the year, he wouldn't have to pay the tax on his salary either. So he's going to save more money by not paying the Social Security tax on the salary he'll get through the end of the year. Plus, he's going to earn two more months of service towards his retirement. He'll accumulate, as he said, more annual leave, which is going to be additional cash payment. So even though he's going to have to pay the Social Security tax when he cashes out that annual leave next year, he may be in a lower federal tax bracket. He might be in a place where he doesn't have to pay state income tax on his retirement benefits. So I think I would probably still wait till the end of the year to retire.
And that's a good problem to have, too.
It is.
Maxing out Social Security.
Very interesting.
Here's one from Sharon. If you retire at the end of a calendar year where the last pay period extends into the next calendar year, i.e. ends 1/10/2015, can you make catch-up contributions to the TSP in 2015 from the payout of your annual leave? If so, how much?
Yeah, a lot of people would like to do that. In fact, the TSP, I don't know if they've looked at this or there's a bill in Congress to allow this, and that has been talked about, but it's not available. So ever since, I guess, 2008, when the stock market went down and everybody had worries about economy and the budget in the Congress, so no, you can't contribute to the TSP from your lump sum annual leave check, only from your biweekly basic pay.
That's right. That has been introduced.
And I guess the lump sum leave is not basic pay, which hence you can't contribute.
It's definitely not a high priority item.
No,
Congress.
No.
In the back and forth, angling to get you on the show, and I'm so grateful you came in today. I discovered that every day, every month is 30 days in the government.
That's right. At least when you're retired. So you're not really losing time.
What does that mean?
That means that whenever OPM pays your retirement check, it's based on a 30-day month. So if you added up 30 days a month times 12 months, it's a 360-day year. So everything's based on this 30 days. So if you retire, let's say, January 31st, like this one woman was going to do, you retire close of business that day. So you're going to get credit for the full month of January, but it's still only 30 days, not 31 days. If you retire the end of February, we're going to add 3 days to your service because we still want to give February 30 days. It's confusing and complicated, and I'm trying to think of an easy way to explain it, but it's just that we give that 30-day increment when we're adding up your service or when we're determining how much time you have for retirement. So at the end of the calculation, if you end up with 35 years, 9 months, and 29 days, that's 1 day short of a month. It doesn't matter what month it is. They all have 30 days.
Yeah.
So we always count that as a 30-day month. Same thing when a CSRS employee retires, where they can go out the first, second, or third day of a month. They're still going to become a retiree that month. They'll still get a check for the rest of the month. But if you retire January 3rd, you're only going to get 27/30 of the check, not 27/31 of the check. So we still count that as a 30-day month.
Wow, okay. So
it's strange.
That's a good pop question. Tammy, you do seminars with NITP, and I want to ask you when we come back from a break here, what's frequently asked questions and things people don't know. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com. Hey, while we were off the air, Lauren Larson took a call from Glenn at Health and Human Services, and he's frustrated. He said he's supposed to contact two different retirement people at his agency. He continues to email them, haven't heard back from either, would like to know how to get their attention without taking some sort of drastic action, and he wants to retire in May. And you had an interesting comment about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think they should at least respond and give him an update, but I think what's happening is that most agencies this month and even into next month, they're trying to get, they have deadlines. They have to get all the retirement cases out of there so they can get to OPM to start getting processed. So they probably have a deluge of applications that came in, I'm assuming, in January or the end of December, that they're trying to right now get out the door before January 31st, if at all possible. So they don't have time to respond because they probably have this many cases and two people to do it. So I would say just be patient. I've been at agencies, like yesterday I was Army, and the Army Benefits Center is now telling people it's taking 6 months before they can get to your retirement estimate request. Because you have to remember, if there's a death in service, that's always going to take precedence, and that's time consuming. If you have a disability case, you want to get that out because the person's, you know, sick and they're on leave without pay, so you got to get theirs out. Then I get all the retirements, and we have so many people eligible to retire. Many are leaving now, so we got all those retirement cases. Some agencies are still doing early outs, and that even ups the ante. So the estimates is the last thing we're going to do. So I just say, unfortunately, try to have some patience because it's a fixed number of people doing work that probably requires extra staff that they don't have.
Right, and we've got the potential for the perfect storm here with the retirement tsunami that everybody's been talking about. It could start this month, certainly next month, because you have the full credit for the unused leave. You have the phased retirement, which once that's put into place, that's going to produce a groundswell.
That'll
of retirement.
Be interesting.
So
yeah,
could be a lot of people going out.
Looking forward, to see how that gets implemented.
Tammy, you've done hundreds of seminars over the year, and it intrigued me the other day. We were talking, and you said that every now and then, and almost every seminar, and these are smart people. They've been in government a long time, most of them, but there were some people that are surprised to learn that they get a retirement benefit. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, especially when I do a FERS class, because there's so much emphasis on the thrift savings plan, and I think that's all they think they have, you know, that and Social Security, which they don't believe is going to be there. So they're saving every last dime and, you know, doing everything they can because they think they're going to have to live on their savings, which, yes, the thrift plan is important. But I spend the first part of my seminars really explaining, really cementing the fact that you have three sources of income. You know, the thrift plan certainly is one. Social Security will be another. It will be there. It may not be much, but it'll be there. And then you have a pension. You have a basic benefit, or some people call it your FERS annuity, and that's administered by the Office of Personnel Management, which, you know, most people do know, but there are some people who don't. Mm-hmm. They discount that piece, or they don't even know it exists. And that's going to replace a set amount of your income. If you have 30 years of service, it's going to replace about a third of your income without saving a dime in the thrift. So at least you have that to fall back on. along with Social Security that for some people will replace another third of your income.
Right, and the FERS annuity is indexed or partially indexed to inflation, so that's another very good thing.
And it's a lifetime, it never runs out.
Right, and of course it entitles you to the federal health insurance in retirement. That's another thing I get from I always get from retirees is they say, I'm going to retire, can I keep my health insurance? Yeah.
And they also want to know, can I keep it at the same price?
Yeah.
They think that the government stops helping them. Yeah, yes, you can keep it. You have to meet two requirements. You have to be eligible to retire when you leave. In other words, you can't resign. And then secondly, you have to have had the coverage for the last 5 years, the final 5 years of your career, which most people have had it their whole career. So as long as you meet those two tests, then it just follows you. You know, your agency will transfer the coverage to OPM. The premiums, as you pay them now, the employee share, not the government share, you just pay the employee share once a month out of your FERS or CSRS retirement check. You have it for the rest of your life unless you choose to cancel it, which I would not recommend.
Don't do. You can suspend, but don't cancel.
You suspend, right? Some people can suspend.
Yeah, well, it's interesting with that insurance thing, and I like to hit it a lot during open season because I think that five-year rule has tripped up more people. Mm-hmm. I know two people who had to continue working in government for another five years so they could be eligible for the insurance. So you need to know the five-year rule.
You have to know how it works, absolutely.
Is there a most asked question in your seminars?
It depends on the seminar because we're now teaching, and I almost think this should be the trend. We're now teaching employees who only have 5 years on the job.
Oh, yeah.
Which under FERS, that's really the time to start. And I think you need to update it every 5 years because your life changes and the rules change. But I really applaud the young folks who are coming in at age 27 to learn about their retirement, how to save in the thrift. So their main questions are, number one, is Social Security going to be there?
Sure.
If we don't think it is, at least that's what they say.
Yeah.
And they also want to know how to invest in the thrift plan to make the most of that. So they need to know about managing that investment and how to really make sure that there's going to be enough money there so someday they can afford to retire. At the mid-career level, they're mostly asking about, you know, life changes. You know, what if I get divorced? What if I get married? You know, what if, how can I retire 10 years from now? So they're just trying to figure out, you know, when life takes a turn, you know, how do I change the plans and how do I make different choices? And, you know, so for them, we just review all the basic benefits, make sure they understand spousal rights and the eligibility rules for when you can retire and how to compute the basic benefits. So they get that information. And finally, at retirement, like the pre-retirement classes like I taught yesterday, we get an awful lot of questions about health insurance and Medicare.
Yeah.
Do I need Medicare if I have health insurance, which is a valid question? Also, what do I do with a thrift plan? Do I leave it in a thrift? Do I move it all to G fund? Do I have to take it out? So they want to know what to do with all this money they've saved. And some of them are frankly surprised to see the balance in their thrift.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, wow, how did I get all this money?
Yeah, the last couple of years, things were dragging. And
absolutely.
Well,
I met two millionaires last week.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Self-made. Got another one here. A CSRS employee with 44 years of service will stay several more. Is there a magic retirement date, even though he's already met the max?
You can take your pick.
Good man.
You can retire any day you want to retire.
Yeah.
When you've had enough, that's the day you should retire. Because why I'm saying that is with 44 years of service, this guy or this gal is working because they really enjoy their job. Because their retirement now under civil service is replacing 80% of their high three. And when you compare that to your full salary and the deductions that come out versus the deductions out of your retirement check, they're probably actually paying the government to work.
I've heard people say that. Obviously, Peter likes his job.
Mm-hmm. If he's trying to max out his annual leave lump sum, then wait till the end of the year like everybody else and save up your annual leave because that's a nice paycheck. But he's going to get another lump sum. Hopefully, he's aware of it.
And with 44 years, he'll get 80% of his salary.
80% of his high three, and he's made excess contributions to civil service.
Yeah.
So he's going to get all the money back for the last 2 years of his service that he's paid into civil service. That could be thousands of dollars. That could be more than his lump sum leave check.
You know, one thing I've noticed is observing some of your retirement classes, and most of the ones I've seen are people that are very close to retirement. But it's almost like a light bulb goes off, and they think you can just see many of them thinking, you know, I always thought I made a mistake. I should have gone to the private sector, blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly when they see the benefits at the end of the rainbow, continuation of health insurance at, at group rate prices, an annuity indexed to inflation, the thrift savings plan where the employer has, if you're first, has matched 5%, suddenly like, hey, I'm glad I stayed in the, I'm glad I'm in this room today.
What's even more surprising to me is when I see the FERS employees finally get it.
Yeah.
Because they've had this chip on their shoulder since 1984, thinking they're in this inferior retirement system.
Yeah.
And now they start to add up the numbers, and they compare it to someone under civil service, and they're just as good, if not better off.
The TSP, when it was set up, it was designed to replace a third to a half of their income, depending on the market. Tammy Flanagan, thanks for being on today. We're going to take a short break here. Come back. We'll be talking with Andy Medici from the Federal Times about the intelligence community, State of the Union, and various other things. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com. Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. Thanks for being with us. And a reminder that all of our shows are archived here on our homepage. So, for instance, the one we just had with Tammy Flanagan about best dates to retire and retirement tips and all that will be archived. Should be up about noon, so you can tell people about it and listen again and again. Now I'm going to be talking with Andy Medici. He's a writer for the Federal Times. And Andy, are you there?
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be
here,
Mike.
Thank you. Thank you. Listen, I was at Barnes & Noble the other day, and I bought a History of the Medicis, so I'm going to find out all about your family and where they hid the money.
Please don't say any of that on the air, though.
Okay,
storied history.
Yeah, okay. Andy, I noticed you had a piece this week in the Federal Times that said lawmakers call for Clapper's ouster, and Clapper, of course, is what, the Director of National Intelligence?
Yeah, so the problem with a lot of people are feeling right now is that there should be some accountability for some of the revelations that former contractor Snowden revealed in terms of what intelligence agencies are doing. So there are a few lawmakers who wrote a letter calling for his ouster because of what they think is sort of incomplete testimony and sort of not coming clean about what intelligence agencies are doing on the people's behalf. But, you know, it's one of those things where there's a lot of intense emotions on both sides of the issue in terms of what intelligence agencies should be doing and how much they should be doing of it.
Well, I think a lot of people, myself included, are confused by this, like the Director of National Intelligence. So he is he heads the whole intelligence operation, and things like CIA, NSA come under that?
Well, he sort of coordinates and is in charge of things from the White House perspective, and of course each of the agencies has their own. There's a lot of sort of shared responsibilities and a sort of complex chain of command, but he is the go-to guy in the White House for these sorts of issues.
Well, you know, and I would say this, whoever was president and whichever party controlled the Congress, but I always wonder if a Republican was in the White House and the Congress was controlled by the Democrats, if the Democrats wouldn't be leading the charge to oust this guy. Because I notice in your story, the majority of the it's five Republicans and one Democrats. Maybe if the White House was under different management, if it wouldn't be five Democrats and one Republican.
Well, that's the trick, right? It's always hard to tell, and it's, you know, hard to gauge, but I know that there is a feeling within both parties at the moment that there's been some overreach, and even though most of the lawmakers signed the letter are Republican, there are efforts in both parties to sort of reform the process and to sort of shed some light on what's been going on.
Well, I can't help thinking, too, that oftentimes when members of Congress come down hard on a federal agency for doing something, in this case, they feel NSA is overstepping its bounds. If along came some disaster, then they would immediately want to know, why didn't you know this? Why didn't you tell us? I mean, it's sometimes in intelligence like a no-win situation.
Well, that's definitely one of the issues that, you know, people struggle with is that, you know, if there was an event tomorrow or the next day or the next week, you know, would we all be feeling differently? And, you know, after September 11th and, you know, the military actions in Iraq and Afghanistan, they were given a lot of latitude and a lot of leeway. But I think now a lot of people feel like that should be dialed back and that a lot of those were sort of wartime. It's hard to tell, though. You know, you can never sort of predict or guess for the future. You can only sort of act on what you know now, and a lot of people feel like there should be at least some oversight and some transparency in those efforts.
Yeah, the Washington mantra is, what did you know and when did you know it, and that sort of thing. You mentioned Edward Snowden, the NSA contractor, and it's interesting, here in Washington, D.C., the Metro buses have a large banner, photos of him on the side of them, and some organization has... is paying, and they see him as a hero and a whistleblower, and they want get contributions or something. But it's funny to see this face pass by, and you know he's meantime having press conferences in Moscow.
Well, you know, it's sort of global. You know, back when the Pentagon Papers were released, you know, Daniel Ellsberg, he was let out on bail, and he stuck around. He sort of spoke his case because he wasn't in immediate danger of going to jail. And I think it's times have changed, and you know, Snowden hopped on a plane to Hong Kong and then to Moscow, and that's where he'll be for the time being until the United States government can either figure out, you know, what to do with him or he returns willingly.
I wonder in cases like that how people actually live. I mean, how they physically live and eat and whatnot. I checked with the McDonald's. There is a McDonald's in a Moscow airport, and the price of a Big Mac and fries and a Coke is slightly less than it is here, but you can't live that way forever.
Well, I mean, I think that the terms of his staying in Russia was, I think, supposed to be for about a year. So, you know, this is one of those things where it could be on a sort of permanent but temporary basis, depending on where he is. So it's really anyone's guess on how this will eventually end up and where he'll eventually be in the future.
Yeah, and where he's paying rent. That's I always wonder about things like that. Yeah, I noticed your colleague, Sean Riley, had a piece about the Snowden affair and this USIS. The outfit that does a lot of the background checking for the federal government.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of issues going on with that. You know, there's a case against them that, you know, a lot of the background checks that they've done were just sort of pushed over to the agency. There wasn't a lot of diligence. There wasn't a lot of work on them. And that has sort of sparked a much larger debate, too, about how much role should contractors have in the background check process? What should background checks be? And how useful are they in cases like this, where you had someone who sort of had a mental sort of epiphany, at least in their minds, that they should do something like this. And that's sort of drawn into the debate, sort of what the security clearance process should be and who should have those clearances.
Well, and we always have this debate, both the Democrats and the Republicans at different times, the Democrats during the Clinton years and the Republicans nearly all the time are pushing for more things to be contracted out. And this work, which used to be done by the Office of Personnel Management, was contracted out as part of the downsizing effort, I think, during the Clinton years, and it turned over to the private sector. And now the allegations are, and this is from the Justice Department and a former employee who was fired, who has now got the title of whistleblower, is saying that they were told to dump these things, that they got a certain bonus if they completed a background check before the end of the month, and if it went over that magic date, they got only 75% of the payments. So he alleges that he was told, that his section was told to dump these and not do the contracts. And this may be, again, an allegation of how Snowden and these other people got through.
Well, yeah, you know, there was a reform back right after, you know, 9/11, because there was a large security clearance backlog, and the legislation sort of offered a timeline that security clearance background should be done within 60 days. And so a lot of the backlog was cleared that way, but now you're at the point where you're sort of being paid to just sort of dump them as quickly as possible. And that's, you know, definitely if these allegations are proven out in court, then this is definitely going to shake up security clearances in a pretty big way and sort of have Congress, you know, maybe the administration reevaluate the role not only that contractors play, but sort of what the security clearance process should be at all, you know?
Yeah, I guess this is why things are cyclical in Washington. We swing one to the right and to the left in these things, and whatever they do, eventually it comes back to haunt them, and then they change it and go back to the old way.
Well, you know, it's hard to say that you're wrong, but, you know, when you have a situation that comes up, you know, Snowden and there have been some other recent examples, it does force you to reevaluate. And, you know, hopefully you're not one of those members of Congress that passed that law before and that you can sort of grab that clean slate and move ahead with it. But you're right, it's cyclical, and it's all about trying to strike the right balance. with the right selection of agencies and people involved.
Well, and it's always interesting, too, that when Congress and or the White House make these decisions to privatize something or get it out of the government, they never extend it to themselves, because by that rationale, Congress would not be protected by the U.S. Capitol Police. There would be rent-a-cop guards up there, but they want the best security. And, of course, the White House has the Secret Service, and nobody's talking about privatizing anything like that. So the people who have the power to force this on the rest of the country don't play the game.
I think when you ask someone, you know, what is an inherently governmental activity, it always changes depending on who you ask, right? So, of course, Congress will think that that a lot of the amenities that they get, you know, are inherently governmental. And, you know, it's all about what President Obama said in the State of the Union address, which is that there's been this debate about how strong a role the government should play and what role should the government play. And so this is just one of the many offshoots, which is, you know, what activity should the federal government take on, and which one should it leave to the private sector or to contractors? And that seems to be underpinning almost any debate we have right now.
You're right, and that comes back again and again each and every administration. You know, it was twice now there have been efforts to privatize a collection of income taxes, and now they're looking at putting non-postal workers in outlets and in some big box companies. So this debate will never end.
No, I definitely think you're right. You know, and it's all about, you know, as you were saying before, there's a push and pull in different directions. So, you know, depending on who you ask, there's either been progress or there's been
sure.
losses on both sides.
We'll be talking about this 10 years from now. Andy, thank you very much for being
Thanks
along.
For having me on.
See you next week, I hope.
Yes, take care.
And thank you. Remember, again, our show's archived. You can listen to it. Today's show, starting at noon, it will be up there. We'll see you next Wednesday. Have a good week.